This is the Improved Photography Podcast, episode number 137. Thrice is nice. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create your photography portfolio or to even sell your photographs on a website. You can also make beautiful websites and blogs as well. Squarespace features an elegant interface, gorgeous templates, and incredible 24/7 customer support. Try Squarespace at squarespace.com and enter offer code IMPROVE at checkout, and that'll give you 10% off your order. Squarespace, build it beautiful. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Improved Photography Podcast. Today, you are joined by thousands and thousands of photographers from all over the globe, all sitting down virtually for our weekly dose of photography knowledge. I'm your host, Jim Harmer, and today I'm joined by Jeff Harmon, Darren Meller, and Nick Page. Welcome to the show, everybody.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we have had a ton of questions this week from our listeners on our new Improved Photography Podcast Facebook group. So there's the Improved Photography Facebook page that has well over 500,000 people on it. But this is just our little group of just people who are listening to the podcast. So search Improved Photography Podcast, and it's a way that you can connect with us. We're commenting on everybody's stuff. If you want to get a hold of one of the hosts, just chat with us photography during the week. That's how you can do it. Well, Darren Carroll asks, I'm having a hard time deciding between the Nikon D750 and the Nikon D7200. He shoots family portraits as well as high school sports. And he's been shooting a Nikon D80 for 8 long years now. And so he's ready to decide. So the basic question is, do you go with a low-end full-frame camera or a high-end crop sensor camera? The difference in price is pretty substantial between these two cameras. It's about $1,000 more to go with the full frame camera, in addition to what you'll be paying in lenses if he doesn't already have any. So it's a big jump, and is it really worth it? What do you say, Nick?
I would say it kind of depends on which sports you're shooting. High school sports can get so dim and so dark. If you're shooting football or basketball or volleyball, any of those indoor or nighttime sports, it gets so incredibly dark. And the difference that you're going to see between a full frame camera and a crop sensor camera is pretty huge in that situation, because literally with my full frame camera, I'm pushing, even with fast glass, I'm pushing my ISOs often to 8,000 and 10,000 ISO during these dimly lit football games. So it kind of depends on which sports you're shooting, because, you know, if you're shooting baseball or soccer or any of those daytime sports, you're not going to notice nearly the quality difference between full frame and crop. And you're actually going to appreciate the faster frames per second and the extra reach you get. So in my opinion, it totally depends on which sports you're going to be shooting.
Yeah, that's a great point. I remember last year I was shooting my niece's volleyball game, and the parents were all struggling trying to get any kind of picture. And I thought, no problem. So I brought out my camera, and I had, you know, a 7200 f2.8 and a full frame body. And it was just all I could do to barely get the photos, you know, reasonably frozen in time and a proper exposure. You know, in those, you know, middle school, high school gymnasiums or under the lights at night, I mean, it's just tough no matter what gear you have. So if that's the kind of stuff that you're doing, Darren, yeah, you're going to want to go with the full frame camera. But if not, if you're only doing the sports stuff very casually and you're doing a lot of portraits and stuff, man, I love my crop sensor camera. In fact, I just sold all my full frame gear because I prefer the Fuji X-T1 mirrorless. But never, ever, ever buy a Fuji X-T1 if you're going to do sports photography. It's just the wrong tool for you. It's awesome for everything else, but not for that. What do you think about that, Jeff?
I love my crop sensor too. But the thing I love most about it was the price. So I feel for the questioner here. And my recommendation, maybe not, I don't know if it applies so much to Darren since he's been shooting 8 years. He may have gone through and got the lenses, but the progression to get from crop to full frame, my recommendation is to do it with lenses first. You can't take the crop sensor lenses, the ones built specifically for crop, and use them on the full frame. So you have to get the full frame lenses you have to buy them first. So as a hobbyist anyway, I would do it one lens at a time. And as soon as you have the assortment of full frame lenses, then you make the jump to the full frame camera.
Yeah, that's a great point. And every once in a while, I get the question of people saying, well, wait, you can use crop sensor lenses on the full frame camera. It just doesn't work the same, right? And the answer, in effect, is no, you can't. On the Nikon cameras, yes, they do mount. And yes, you can still take a picture, but it has a crazy black box all around the edges. On Canon cameras, it just can't won't even mount. Yeah. The answer is just no. I mean, no one would ever do that. No sane person would ever do that.
Nope.
All right. In our main segment, we want to talk a little bit about concert photography and learn some tips about that. I am the worst concert photographer on the planet, at least probably because I've never even been to a music concert. I'm sure I've heard like the squeaking orchestras and stuff, but I've never been to like a popular music kind of concert before. And my wife tells me I'm such a stiff, but I just have never done it before. So Nick, I know you shot some pretty big bands this week. How in the world did you get credentials to shoot? Because you like shot, wasn't Mumford & Sons there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was Mumford & Sons.
That is awesome.
And maybe you've heard of the Foo Fighters, the Flaming Lips. Like there was some really large bands, and it was such a cool experience. The way that I got into this gig was that I shoot on occasion for a local magazine called Walla Walla Lifestyles Magazine. So that was my ticket in. So I contacted the promoter and I said, "Hey, I want to shoot this."
So is this like one of those free magazines that you see everywhere?
Yeah, it's
okay.
It's a free magazine that kind of it's connected with the local paper, so it comes out monthly. It's a fairly popular magazine, but it's it's not like National Geographic or anything. It's okay. It's a little bit. It's a couple rungs down, maybe. But
gotcha.
So that was my ticket in. That was my excuse to shoot the show. And
so, did you ask the magazine if, hey, can I ask the ask the bands if I go shoot, or did you have the magazine write a letter for you? How did it work?
Nope. I didn't let them know because I didn't want them to say no. So I just, as a photographer, like I end up contacting clients pretty often for the newspaper, for the magazine. So it's not totally out of left field that I did it. I did this fully knowing that they would probably not be interested in shooting and doing any kind of article about the show, because they don't really deal in the news. They deal with like looking forward rather than looking behind. So like,
gotcha.
So I just used that as an excuse. And I,
right.
About 6 months ago, I started, making contacts and trying to get my foot in the door. I didn't know until about 3 days before the show that yes, I was going to have a press credential, and I was going to get to shoot all of the bands except for the Foo Fighters from the pit. So I got to shoot like 20 bands from like 5 feet away. And this festival had between 20 and 25,000 people in attendance. And it was, whoa, it was like Woodstock. It was so amazing. Such a cool experience. And shooting the Mumford & Sons was amazing because they have one of the most high-tech lighting and stage setups. And it was just so much fun because every single frame that you take is completely different because the light is changing so fast. And
so what's the area like for photographers? Like where did you get to be? Yeah, I mean, you have credentials. So where do you get to go?
That credential got me into the thing for free, which in itself was worth $200. So that was cool. And then I got to be in that area between the barrier where the people can't go any closer and the stage. So I was
like spitting distance.
Yes. Yes. Easily. And
right.
So, and I was right up
sweating
against
distance.
I was right.
Crowd surfer falls on your head distance.
Exactly. And not to mention, like I'm up against these huge subwoofers for this huge outdoor show. So like I was having heart palpitations with the beat because it was just so much bass. I can't even express how awesome it was because it was so loud.
And so how many photographers are there?
In the beginning, there wasn't very many, like in the first part of the day, because this is an all day festival. So the bands that started at like noon were not super popular. but the bands that played at night were super popular. So there would be like three photographers in the pit in the beginning of the day. And by the end, like when Mumford and Sons played, there was like 35 photographers in a small area. So the way it works is you have three songs to get the shots you want, and then they kick you out. And so everybody is like on the clock. We're all like hurrying to get the shots that we want. And we're like all swapping lenses and going to the other side of the stage and getting shots from both sides and getting the wide shot from the center. And so we're all just like fighting over positions and we have to shoot around the cameramen that were actually videotaping the performance. And
okay, so you're there. It's crazy. Tell me, what kind of camera settings did you start out with?
Well, in the middle of the day, it's like ISO 200 and, you know, 1/800th to 1/1250th of a second. A lot of times I was shooting wide open just because my 70 to 200 is sharp and, you know, middle of the day stuff was super easy. But as it got later in the evening and the stage lights start coming on, we're starting to talk about ISO 1600 to ISO 2000 area. And because they're moving, I had to use fairly fast shutter speed. So I was trying not to ever dip below like 1/400th of a second or so. And a lot of times I was shooting wide open in those situations. Like I said, the 70 to 200 is nice and sharp. But when I was doing the wider shots, I would stop down to like F4, F5, 6 or something just to get everything sharp. And the shutter speed didn't matter quite as much when I'm shooting super wide. So
I see you across the pit and I'm like, hey, that's Nick Page. Nick, what camera settings do I use? Right?
Yeah.
Like it's night, everything's dark. We're in a live music hall, a bar or whatever it is. Like, I know you always shoot in manual mode, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And we're probably going to shoot wide open aperture just to gather light.
Yep.
And then what about a shutter speed?
Shutter speed, it depends on how energetic the band is, essentially. So like,
okay,
if you're
how much headbanging are we talking about?
Exactly. If you're shooting a speed metal band that is just like headbanging like crazy and you want to freeze the action, you're going to be shooting at like 1/800th of a second and faster.
What is the shutter speed of a headbang?
Exactly.
All right. And then are you shooting super high ISO?
Because the stage lights were so dramatically bright, I didn't really have to in this case, but there was a venue that I shot at, the day before. It was an indoor venue with a metal band. So things are moving and it's really dark. And in those situations, I was clear up to ISO 8000, ISO 10000, and it was rough. I was still not freezing the action. So you just kind of have to deal with a little bit of blur at that point because, you know, I don't want to push my ISO any higher than ISO 10000. That's about as much as a 5D Mark III can do without like crying. So it was
okay. So, you know, flights or, you know, lights are flashing everywhere. Mm-hmm. People with epilepsy are freaking out.
Yep.
And, you know, things are just going crazy in there. How are you shooting in manual mode and getting a consistent exposure between the shots? Because the light's changing all the time.
Well, I'm accounting for it in my head. So I get into a place where I know that I'm exposing for my highlights, which in this case is super important because the majority of your frame in these kind of shots is dark, but then you have these really bright rim lights and really bright beams of light coming through, and you don't want to overexpose those because once they're gone, they're pretty much gone. If you blow out a color channel, it's not going to come back. I get to a place where I know that I'm not overexposing, and then if I see things get super bright, I either adjust quickly with my shutter speed and just kind of guess and take a picture and look at the back of my camera and see how close my guess was and then go from there, because things are changing so fast that you just have to be fluid with it. So a lot of times, you know, I get to that middle ground. If it gets really bright, I speed up my shutter speed. If it gets really dark, I slow it down, because oftentimes if it gets really dark, the music kind of slowed down anyways, and it's getting all like dramatic and moody. So they stop moving so fast as well. And so that slower shutter speed works. So that's kind of how it was. And
so did you find yourself using your Expo disc since you love that thing so much? Or?
Nice.
No, I did not.
Oh, yeah. We're getting all kinds of jabs on Nick today. Nice. That's great.
Yeah, wasn't a great scenario for the Expo disc.
All right, so be honest. After you got the Expo disc and you bought it and said it was great, even though we heard the report and it was, I don't know how you said it was great because you'd only complained about it. How many times have you used it since then?
Do we really have to talk about this right now?
Death to gray cards. Those things are useless, baby.
One of these days, I will bust it out again. And I'm sure it'll perform brilliantly. But
I'm sure it will.
You should use it in the night sky shootout that you're going to have.
I should.
Yeah.
I will have a use nice it then gray
for sure,
sky.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
Oh, that's great. So I noticed as I looked through your photos, the photos were awesome, by the way, that you got from the concert.
Yeah,
I mean, some really, really cool stuff. A lot of them are just dramatically underexposed from what, you know, the camera would get on auto, you know, where you're trying to get everything in the picture to have detail. I mean, there's a lot of like, you know, 80-85% of the picture is black. And then we're getting like this little rim light around the person. Mm-hmm. And the effect is super, super cool. Did you find that you were shooting mostly in that style to get kind of just the edges of people and a lot of darkness in the photo, kind of a very low key thing? Or was that just kind of the style that ended up working the best?
Well, when I was shooting, with my highlight alert on. And I was being very careful not to overexpose.
Blinkies, I hate those things.
I know. I have them on too.
But this was a great example for that because if I overexpose those, they're not going to come back and I'm just going to ruin the shot. And I don't want to have these snow white halos in a shot that where they should obviously be, you know, have some kind of color to them. So I was making sure to expose for the highlights because obviously any kind of auto mode, like even aperture priority or shutter priority or anything like that, it would have been so utterly confused by what was going on. My camera probably would have just went up in smoke because the lights were changing so fast that none of those modes would have even kind of worked. It would have just overexposed everything. I was shooting in manual and making sure that I was not getting too many blinkies. The trick is you want to get some, but not too many because you know you can recover some. You can recover, what is it, like a stop and a half or something with the highlight slider when you're shooting raw. So I was kind of keeping that in mind.
Not only that, but the highlights are going to be showing off of a JPEG.
Yeah, exactly.
Because the camera is not looking at the raw. Mm-hmm. So that's why you can recover so much on raw. It has a lot more room than the JPEG blinkies will show.
Right. So I was exposing the photo as much as I could without losing detail. And in most cases, you know, I really didn't edit the photos too heavily at all. I was just adding some contrast. This was one of the situations where I actually did add a little bit of clarity. I'm actually an anti-clarity slider guy. I don't know if you guys know this about me, but I hate the clarity slider. Yeah.
Those are fighting words, right? Do you have like support groups?
Exactly, yeah. We meet on Thursdays. This case...
It's not this group.
No, it's definitely not this group.
Yeah, I love clarity. So.
But in this case, it was really nice because it brought out some of the texture of all the smoke and stuff that was, you know, creating the nice ambient effect. So that's about
very
it.
Very cool. And what was your most used lens?
70-200 because...
Did you just glue it on or do you even use other things?
Oh, yeah. I definitely used other things. I had my Trinity with me. I had my 16-35, 28-70, and 70-200 in my bag with me. And most of the time, I never needed the 16-35 because it was such a large stage. I would say it was 6 feet tall and it was probably 6 feet away from me.
2 meters.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so
I was feeling for our international audience.
Yeah, I know. Exactly. And
good job.
But they'll know Mumford and Sons. They're a British band. But anyways, so 16-35 was just like a little bit ridiculously wide. Like I could almost shoot behind me. I was angling up so much. So 28-70 and the 70-200 were my most used lenses.
Cool. So did you make any mistakes? Anything you regret from shooting?
I'm flawless. I don't know if I ever make this.
You are flawless. Except for that Expo-disc thing.
You know, I think I gave up on the shows a little bit too early. Like I was in such a hurry to be the first to post some of the photos from the show that I left before they were over, and I missed really cool opportunities because I only got to shoot from the pit for 3 songs each. And then the rest of the night, I could just shoot from out in the crowd, and which is really difficult because essentially I would have to go out in the middle of the sea of people and then try to pre-focus on the person on the stage through the people using back button focus. And then I would throw it into live view and then hold it up above my head and shoot just like everybody else with their cell phones. And
yeah.
I don't know if you've held a 70 to 200 with a battery grip up above your head for very long, but it gets old really quick. And so I shot a few songs.
Did you
songs
at least crowd surf to the spot?
You know, I don't think that anybody wanted that. I don't think I judged the group and they didn't look up to it. So I didn't.
Well, we want to get on and talk about our 5-minute segments of the week. But before we do that, I want to take a second and thank 2 people who make the Improved Photography Podcast possible and free. And the first is Animoto. You all know that I love Animoto. Animoto is the best way to make your photography sing online. You can just upload your photos. You can even put in video clips. All up to Animoto, and very quickly you can arrange your photos, add music to it, and you have a beautiful slideshow in just a matter of minutes. Video is taking the web by storm, and so for still photographers, it can be really tough to totally switch around and add all the video stuff into your workflow and even into your business. But slideshows are a great way to add a little bit of motion, a little bit of video into your marketing, to, you know, have a video to put up on Facebook and YouTube. And those are usually shared around really, really well. And also something to offer clients and the people that you shoot for. I even use it for my family reunion and things like that, not even shooting professionally. And so there are tons of ways to use Animoto, and we love using it. You can visit animoto.com/improve. That's animoto.com/improve, and be sure to use offer code IMPROVE to get 15% off your annual pro subscription. And we really thank Animoto for supporting Improved Photography. And also by Squarespace. Squarespace is the best way that I have found to make my website. I have struggled for years to get a good portfolio website that works good on mobile, that I don't spend so much time just working on the technology of, but that I can actually just share my photos, have it work, have a contact form on there that works every time, and get my photos big on the screen. That's one thing that I have to have in my photography portfolio. I want full screen pictures, and very few places that I've found have made that as seamless for me as Squarespace has been. Plus, plans start at just $8 a month. So check it out at squarespace.com. You can sell your photography on there. You can have your photography blog on there. You can share your portfolio on there. It really is the best thing that I've found for doing it. I'm using Squarespace. Nick, I know you're using a Squarespace site, and Darren, you're using Squarespace. And the cool thing is, you go look at all of our websites and you really wouldn't even guess it's a Squarespace site. They all look totally custom and unique. And that's another thing that I love about Squarespace. So we thank them for supporting Improved Photography. They also have 24/7 customer support for just $8 a month. I mean, if you think about it, that really is incredible. When you go to sign up, go to squarespace.com, and you can use the offer code IMPROVE to get 10% off your first purchase. That's squarespace.com and use offer code IMPROVE. All right, we want to move on to our round robin 5-minute segments of the week. And the first one I'm going to throw over to Mr. Jeff Harmon.
Okay, so I have like a geeky reputation to protect here, and I'm gonna live up to it again today.
What are we talking about today?
Let's talk web browsers. And you might be, what does that have to do with photography? But I think it'll be important to a lot of people. So I want to take it. Well, photographers, I mean, we're in Facebook a lot of the day, email, maybe updating the portfolio out of that Squarespace site. So just quick poll here of the hosts. Which browser do you use?
Google Chrome.
Use Chrome on my desktop and Safari on my laptop.
Okay. All right. So why Chrome?
Because it's better.
Because it's better. And do you, have you actually tested it better, or is it because you've heard from other people it's better?
Yeah, I can notice the difference when I'm using Chrome. I like the interface of it, but like it, to me, it really is physically faster. Like it's perceptibly faster.
Yeah. Okay. So here's what's come up. Same thing. I've been using Chrome for a long time now. I started off using Firefox because it kind of predated Chrome a little bit and was a much better alternative, since I'm a PC user, to that horrid Internet Explorer piece of junk. And I switched over. And the reason I did was the startup time was much faster start. It was less resource intensive and it offered better security. It has a sandbox feature that none of the other browsers have had really implemented well. So I had good reasons to do it. And I've been sticking with it for quite a while. I still use Firefox a lot. I have multiple Gmail accounts that I'm in a lot during the day. And so I have one logged in at one Gmail account and another one logged in at another. Mm-hmm. Anyway, as I've been testing for Windows 10, and I'm taking a bunch of measurements about how the software operates, how fast does it boot up, how fast does it take to launch the browser, Firefox, or Lightroom, and so on. And I'm monitoring the resources, seeing how much disk I/O, how much RAM is being taken, and all of this kind of stuff. So I can do it before the upgrade and after, and really kind of try to determine more scientifically than just my opinion about whether or not it was better. And I really come to a startling conclusion. I hadn't done this level of detail analysis between Chrome and Firefox for a while. Chrome is chewing up a lot more RAM than Firefox is. A ton more RAM. And RAM on a lot of machines is really a premium when you're trying to run Lightroom and Photoshop with it. So if you're like me and you're running the browser, you're running Lightroom, and you're running Photoshop all at once,
especially the new versions of Lightroom and Photoshop.
Yeah. Then like Photoshop, when I've been testing it, wants 4 gig of RAM. So, and I have 32 on my PC, 32 gig of RAM. Most people don't have that much. So maybe it's because it can spread out that far that it is, but it wants 4, Lightroom wanted like 3, and then Chrome wanted as much as like 1.6, 1.7, almost 2 gig of RAM itself. And I had about 10 tabs open, so that contributes. The more tabs, the more memory. But I tested it with Firefox, same number of tabs, same exact tabs, and it was like 0.3 gig when it started.
Wow. And so, what about the speed, though?
And the speed is very, very comparable. And you have to think that's in part because it's so much more. Mozilla has really super focused on making it less resource intensive.
Because that's why everybody left it in the first place.
That's right. They were getting toasted because people were abandoning it for Chrome for that very reason. So they have super engineered it to the point where I think right now there is really good reason to switch back. If you're gonna run it with Lightroom and Photoshop, run Firefox, or don't run a browser at all while you're running those two, so that you can give all the RAM to it. But Firefox has much, much smaller footprint on RAM. And that's kind of one of the biggest components to the performance of Lightroom and Photoshop.
That's a very good point. That's why I use Safari, which is the Mac browser built in.
Yeah.
When I'm on my laptop, is because when I'm using Chrome and Lightroom on the laptop, my battery life is cut. I mean, less than half. It is crazy how fast the battery runs out when you're running Lightroom and Chrome. And I have a completely specced out MacBook Air, which, you know, isn't that specced out. They don't give you a whole lot of options. But I mean, it's just crazy how fast the battery gets chewed up when you have both of those running. So I switched to Safari on my laptop because I always have Lightroom open. And so if I have both, my battery just doesn't last.
So try it out with Firefox, Jim. See how that goes. Because yeah, I think it performs a little better than Safari does. So
very cool. All right. Darren, what do you have for us this week?
Well, mine's about image stabilization and leaving it on when you're on the tripod or shutting it off. And I listened to our good friend Juan Pond's Digital Photo Experience podcast as well. And I was mowing the lawn and I was listening to him talking about how with most lenses, and I'm pretty sure he was referring to Canon, that you can actually shut off or leave image stabilization on when you're on a tripod, even for longer exposures, was my understanding. And when we came back from Oregon, my dad took some pictures of this boat that we were out photographing at night, and the pictures were blurry. And we thought, well, maybe bump the camera, etc. And then we did another astrophotography shot before we did the meteor shower that was done recently. And both were shot with Tamron lenses. And we noticed, holy crap, these are blurry. What is going on with this? And believe it or not, I called Tamron and I said, well, what's your recommendation? Does it make a difference between whether or not I'm shooting the 70 to 200, the 24 to 70, the 15 to 30? And they said, no, shut off our, they call it vibration control when you're on a tripod. They didn't specify whether or not it's for longer exposures or not. Just like when you talked about how mirror lockup doesn't always benefit you unless you're using certain shutter speeds. But Tamron's saying that they should shut it off. So, I mean, my question is, with your experience with Nikon, did you have to shut it off? And then also with Nick's experience with Sigma, did you have to shut it off as well when you're shooting on a tripod as well? Because I wanted to open that up to other questions, because like I said, I think Juan Pons is a very, very credible, amazing photographer, but saying that you, on most newer lenses that you can leave it on could be a mistake, especially if Tamron's willing to tell me when I call their customer service line to shut it off on all of their lenses as a blanket statement. You know, that's maybe something that some people might find is a good use case for getting sharper images.
Yeah, this is an interesting topic. And I totally agree with Juan in the Canon sphere. Just keep it on. Okay. And same thing with Nikon. I never once had a problem with a Nikon lens keeping the image stabilization moving around when it was on a tripod. Never once had that issue. On my Fuji, I have had a couple times that, you know, you can hear it. You can hear the image stabilization humming, and you can see it in the image when it's stabilizing. And I have seen that a couple times with one of my lenses that it didn't signal itself off when it was on the tripod. So I'm with you, Darren. I mean, you got to know your gear. If you're shooting Canon and Nikon, I've never had that issue. But I have seen it with Fuji, and I guess if you're seeing it with Tamron as well, that's good information to have.
Do you think, Jim, it would have anything to do with shutter speed, like the mirror lockup test that you did?
I suppose maybe. I mean, I guess we'd have to test those Tamron lenses more to see if they're, you know, turning on or off depending on what shutter speed is set. But I don't know. I have no idea.
And have you noticed any of this at all with Sigma lenses, Nick, since you've shot quite a few Sigmas?
Yeah. You know, I've used them on purpose. I normally turn it off when I go to work on a tripod with the longer lenses and stuff. And there is a lot of times that with a really super long lens, it's actually super useful to leave it on, because if you have any breeze at all, for example, I was shooting the 150 to 600, and it doesn't take much of a breeze at all for it to actually, you know, just start showing tons and tons of shake in the frame. So by leaving the image stabilization on, it would actually compensate for the breeze that was moving my frame around. So I've actually had good experiences with both Sigma and Canon. Like I've never had a reason to turn it off, really. So
that's actually a good point, because there are some lenses that, I mean, it would just be silly to turn it off. Like, mm-hmm. You know, a Nikon 600mm f4, nobody is hand-holding that. You can't. You can't hand-hold it. Right. So obviously the image stabilization is meant to be used even on a tripod, because it's only used on a tripod.
Yeah, once a lens gets to be about 400 millimeters, they shouldn't even put a switch on them anymore. They should just always be on.
Yeah,
because they're totally unusable with it off. Even on a tripod, mm-hmm. You almost need it, unless you have like a really, really awesome heavy tripod. 600 millimeters on a tripod is still shaky. It's, you can see it in live view, like it just quivers.
Yeah.
You can breathe on it and it still shakes. Uh-huh. So it's pretty crazy.
So Darren, it sounds to me like the lesson here is to know your gear and know kind of how it performs. But I will say that shooting Canon and Nikon lenses for years, I've never once had an issue with those specific ones.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think, you know, people should definitely look at their photos and see whether or not that change makes their images sharper.
Good point. Well, today I want to talk about an experience that I had this week. This week I got my brother's cheap $300 DSLR. It's a Nikon D3000, so it's like a what, a 6-year-old DSLR and an 18 to 55 millimeter kit lens. And I went into the kitchen and just saw what I could make. And I filmed the whole thing for the brand new photography class, my brand new beginning photography class that I'm calling Photography Start. And you can get information at that, about that at improvephotography.com/start. And that's coming out very, very shortly. So I just kind of, I chose the kitchen is where I was going to go shoot. And I just kind of pulled out food from the cupboards and stuff and just saw what I could make. And so I want to walk through some of the setups that I used and a couple of the lessons that I learned. If you're on our Improved Photography podcast Facebook group, you've probably already seen the photos. Or if you're following me on Instagram, in fact, you really should come follow all of us, all the podcast hosts on Instagram, because a lot of the things we talk on about on the podcast here are visual. And so come check me out at Jim Harmer on Instagram. Don't search Improved Photography. That's an old account. Just search Jim Harmer. And I'm always posting the photos so that you know exactly what we're talking about on the podcast. Well, the first thing that I did is I got a whole bunch of kind of ingredients for salsa, you know, tomatoes and broccoli for people that like that kind of stuff, and hummus, salsa, all kinds of stuff. And I actually set it on our floor of the kitchen because it's fake wood floor. So I thought that'd be kind of a cool background. And then I put, you know, a cutting board on there, kind of a chunk of canvas there, a knife, just spilled some spices around just to, you know, make it look like a well-used kind of something with some personality. And then for the lighting, all I did is I got a continuous video light and set it on the ground pointing, you know, raking across the ingredients. So just shooting parallel to the ground. And it made great dramatic lighting. If it were the daytime, I totally would have just set everything up next to the window. I mean, what I was trying to do is recreate window light because I wanted nice moody highlights and shadows. You know, a tomato, it just looks like a circle, doesn't look like a sphere unless you have a highlight and a shadow on it. And that's what we see with painters. And when you're learning to draw, is you have to learn to draw highlight and shadow. That's what gives it dimension. Well, photographers sometimes let this go, you know, just forget about that. And so we take a photo without really thinking about, I've got to put highlight and shadow if I want to give this thing dimension. So I use that for my lighting. And, you know, a continuous video light is literally just light bulbs screwed into a big socket. And so just go get a lamp for your lighting. It's going to do the exact same thing. Or put it up next to a window. It's going to do the exact same thing. And I just kind of snapped a picture. I even used auto mode. Because the camera settings, I mean, like, how do you mess up the camera settings for that? Like, the ISO doesn't matter. We had plenty of light. The light was right on it. The aperture doesn't really matter because everything was pretty much flat on the floor. The shutter speed doesn't matter because it was going to be plenty fast for hand holding. So, like, you can just set your settings crazy, and it's pretty hard to mess that up. No need for a tripod, anything. The photography part is easy if you get the settings set up correctly. So I set that up and snapped a couple pictures. I uploaded it to iStock. And I guess just a kind of side note on that, I've done some food photography several years ago. I think it was 3-4 years ago. And I had just uploaded, I think, maybe 4 or 5 shots, something like that. And I looked back now over time to see how those photos have sold. They're not even very great photos, honestly. But they've sold pretty consistently at 1 photo per month per file. So about $5 a month when I have 5 pictures. So, you know, that's nothing, you know, go buy yourself a Big Mac and celebrate. You know, I always think when I do hop on iStock, I always think, man, one of these days I need to just block off a day on the calendar to go upload 200 photos that I have that would be suitable for stock and get $200 a month. I mean, that's pretty cool. And, you know, MicroStock is very much changing and profits are shrinking in there. But if you have some photos that are suitable for stock and extremely clean with noise and everything else, I mean, I still think it's worth your time to at least put them up there. Get a little fun money, blow money or money for camera gear. And you can just go to istockphoto.com and apply to be a contributor there. And there are other stock sites as well. But that's the big one. That's the one that I've used. So it was kind of an interesting experience. And check out Photography Start, where we'll have a lot more of that coming very, very soon.
Very cool.
All right. Well, Nick, tell us about your 5 minutes of the week.
So I saw that we had a question from Paul Coleman, who is asking about shooting real estate interiors. He's asking, how do you deal with the competing color temperatures from the inside light to the outside light? And how do you balance that when you're shooting interiors? And anybody that's shot very much real estate realizes how much of a challenge that it can be. And so I've got some tricks that I use to help balance that. So when I'm shooting my interiors, I'm always shooting bracketed shots. That way I can use Lightroom's HDR feature and I can maintain detail outside the windows and still maintain the shadow detail on the dark parts of the inside of the house. And what I like to do is the first thing, like if I'm going to actually be balancing the blue light coming in the windows with the warm tungsten glow from the lights, the lamps and stuff, what I will do is I will, you know, I'll boost my shadows, I'll decrease my highlights, I'll bring it up to the right exposure. And then I actually go into my HSL panel and I will decrease the saturation of the blues and decrease the saturation of the oranges and a little bit of the yellows. And what that does is it just tones it all down. That way you can find that happy place between the two color temperatures. And it's not going to be, you're not going to have those crazy blue reflections off of the ceiling and off of the floor and stuff. And, but you can still maintain a fairly neutral color cast across the whole image.
That is a really cool tip. I've done this before and it was always a big Photoshop job trying to get the window light to match the interior light. So just decreasing the saturation of those yellows in the HSL panel, that's pretty smart. That's a great tip.
I love the HSL panel. Yep. I use it all the time.
It's awesome.
Useful for everything. And so one of the things that I'll do to kind of cheat that, because most of the time I want my lamps and stuff on, and if I have fluorescent lights, I leave those off. I hate fluorescent lights. I want to rip them out of every house. I just hate them. But lamps and stuff, they really add a nice mood to the shot. But one of the things that I'll do to kind of cheat if I want to create a nice, happy, bright, glowy image is I will actually just turn all the lights off and do a longer set of exposures. That way it appears that, you know, light is just streaming in through whatever window is in that room or windows. And that can create, you know, you're not going to be struggling with your color temperatures because you've only got one, and it creates a nice, bright, happy image. And the reverse of that is I will actually shoot later in the evening during blue hour. That way, the blue that is coming through the windows is not actually very strong. It's actually just, you know, it's fairly dim. And because of that, it's not creating much color cast on the inside of the house. So you can adjust your color temperature to where your lamps and stuff are looking good. Maybe decrease the saturation of the blue and the orange a little bit, but you're not going to be struggling nearly as hard. And because I do the same kind of thing almost in every single photo, I shoot my bracketed shot, I combine those into an HDR photo, and then after that, I pretty much always decrease the saturation of the blues and the oranges, and I boost the shadows and decrease the highlights. I've created a preset for that. So I can, and in addition to that, I will actually go into, in the preset, it uses the lens correction as well as the upright feature. Upright feature is amazing for real estate photography because you're trying to get all your lines straight. And you can get it fairly straight, but when you click that upright feature, oftentimes it just makes it perfect. It's just like the fixer tool. It's amazing. So part of that preset is using the upright tool, and that gets me close to where I want to be, and then I tweak it a little bit, and voila, the real estate agent has to pay me. So that's...
Well, that's really cool. I'd never thought about making a preset for that. Maybe we're gonna have to finding a way to get that in the Lightroom Steel this year. That sounds pretty cool.
Absolutely, that's one of those Nick Page signature presets.
Yeah, that's very cool. Well, the other thing that I do with real estate photography is just use flash, because, you know, if you have kind of yellow lights inside and it's, you know, usually neutral light coming from the outside, is I'll just get a flash even on camera and just point it up at the ceiling. And if you make that flash bright enough, it's going to mostly overpower the ambient light, or at least kind of, you know, mix it in there, dilute it a little bit. And then it's going to more closely match the outdoor light. Is that something you do very often?
It's not something I do very often because it slows me down. But there have been a few shoots where I've like strategically hid flash, you know, speed lights behind like couches and tables and stuff just to create little splashes of
that
lights.
Illuminating couch effect.
Yeah, that's the
rim on that.
Exactly. You know, put some 3-point lighting on that couch, you know, make it a real feature. But it is really cool to just put little splashes of lights like on the walls and stuff. And it's amazing how much dimension that gives the shot. But having said that, you can pretty much recreate it with like the radius filter or whatever in Lightroom, or just, you know, paint it in. There's so much you can do in post now that like it's really hard to feel super motivated to bust out all the speed lights and stuff.
Yeah.
Especially when you don't get paid anymore for it anyways. You can go in and work quick and get paid the same amount as if you go in and make it the most epic real estate photography ever. And then the most frustrating thing in the world about shooting real estate photography is that you go through and you spend all this time getting your framing perfect, you know, working really hard on getting the color temperatures just right, making a nice, awesome, crisp, clean image. And then when they put it on their website, they upload it at like, I don't know, 700 pixels on the long end.
Yeah.
And they just kill it. They destroy it. They put it on this tiny little website that is just awful. So
yeah, the MLS always looks bad.
That is the most frustrating part of shooting real estate, is they never, your pictures never get to see the glory that they deserve. So yeah,
that's right. Well, now we want to talk about the doodads of the week. And I am so excited about my doodad this week. It is unreasonable. I tried to take a nap about an hour ago, and I literally laid there for half an hour and could not sleep because I was so excited about this little device. Like, it was like a little 5-year-old kid on Christmas Eve. It's crazy. It is the Mekon underwater housing for the Fuji X-T1. Here, listen to it. I'm knocking on it. That sucker is solid. It's beautiful. It's got tons of buttons, and it's heavy, and it's hard plastic. I love it. So
wait, heavy? Underwater,
yes. It's a man's underwater housing. It is awesome. So underwater housings are usually super, super expensive. I mean, $2,000. And I've always wanted one for when I shot my Nikon D800, but $2,000, man, that's expensive. And I switched to the Fuji X-T1, which I've been loving. And I saw this one on Amazon for $199, and I thought, no way, right? Because it looks legit. So let's try this out. So I bought it, and I can say that I am way over the top excited with it. I mean, it is just super well built. I dunked it in the sink. Everything looks good so far. I mean, it is just really, really well built. The limitation of it is it only works with the 18-55. Only one lens fits in there. So you got to have the 18-55. But actually, Fuji makes a pretty decent 18-55. And this thing is so cool. So with my full frame cameras, I always used an Ewa Marine underwater bag. And those are, you know, it did fine. I never had any issues with it. However, it's just such a pain in the rear trying to adjust any of the settings. And so this one is, I mean, just beautiful. Every single button and dial on the Fuji, I can adjust. It's just super, super cool. And for $199, I mean, it is a steal. Very, very well built. So the way that I'm going to use this is I'm going to Alaska next week. I'm going to go on a fishing trip. And so I'm going to take a lot of kind of outdoor sports kind of photography. You know, maybe I'll upload it for stock as well, but also just use for tutorials and stuff. So I wanted to get photos like with half the lens under the water. So you can see the salmon caught on the line and then the fisherman in the background. And there's a tripod socket underneath so I can screw it on a monopod and dunk it underwater to get pictures of halibut and stuff. So I'm really excited with this. If you shoot Fuji X-T1 and you ever even maybe consider that you could possibly do something underwater, boom, baby, this thing is awesome. Also clear the schedule for the next week because you won't be able to sleep. It's that cool. I'm going wakeboarding tomorrow and on Saturday with my family, mostly just so I can take pictures of the boat from the underwater camera and try some stuff out that way. I don't care what your doodads of the week are. Not as cool as me. All right, Jeff, what you got for us?
I wanted to talk about a think tank bag. The Shapeshifter is what it's called. And I'm testing lots of bags. We've talked about this on past podcasts that I'm taking them out, hiking with them, testing them out in the real world to see which one I like the best for hiking, to pass that on to the listeners. I got a whole bunch of them sitting back here in my office. So I'm not through them yet, but of the three I've used so far and put to the test, this is the one I like the best, the Shapeshifter. What I like about it is it's a very compact kind of bag. It's not the stiff foam kind of bags that you normally think of and want a lot of times to protect your gear. It looks a lot more like a normal like school backpack, which I know Jim doesn't like as much because it's
very
boring.
Jane looking black.
It's made of like nylon, and the interior has like these little pouches for the lenses, and they even have like drawstrings on the top of the pouches that you can use to close them up. It did great. So I used it while I was out in Oregon on my vacation there. Took it all over the place. I took it up this massive sand hill. There was sand blowing everywhere, and it kept my gear nice and clean, and the bag shows no sign of having any trouble. The zippers on all the Think Tank bags are great, like butter. and they're really good. I like this bag a lot. It's an extremely good bag. I don't know if it'll win the shootout that I've got, but it's a leading contender at this point.
The bag out. All right, Nick, what you got for us?
I probably have the lamest doodad this week. But,
oh, you do? Because hello, hands down. I got the underwater camera.
So my doodad this week is actually a microfiber towel. Yeah, I know. I say that with a sad face.
Don't forget to bring a towel.
it's more handy than you would think to have a towel in your camera bag. And what's nice about these, stop the giggling over there. I hear you. What's nice about these is because it's microfiber, it rolls up really small. It's really compact, fits in the bag really easy. But there's lots of times when you're shooting either at the ocean or near waterfalls or near people that spit, and you need to be able to dry off your camera. So it's super handy to have something, a towel that you can wipe off your camera and even wipe off your lens if you're in a pinch. So the one that I got is like 12 inches by 12 inches. Super, super handy. I like it a lot. And we'll put a link in the show notes. I don't know, remember who makes it. There's tons of them on Amazon. You can get them in lots of different colors. You can get them in pink, Jim. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Wow. Hey, you killed it this week, man.
Especially the color selection.
That's good. Thanks, Nick. All right, Darren, what you got for us?
Mine's an existing doodad. It's been around for quite a while, and we use it quite often, but it's Photoshop. And I started using it more and more because I was finding there was a little bit lack of creativity within my photos. And I went out to shoot the meteor shower, and I'm not saying the name of the meteor shower because I know I make fun of me if I try to mispronounce it. So I asked Nick, I messaged him after I got home. I got one shot of this meteor going over a barn. It was really cool, except for they gave me a hard time for chopping up part of the composition, which is okay. We'll let that pass. And I decided to figure out how to put in multiple meteors within one shot and stitched it together using multiple layers, use smart objects, and relinquish the power of Photoshop, or harness the power of Photoshop to the best of its ability. And the reason I think that I should mention is to do that is I do spend 95% of my time in Lightroom because it is a powerful beast, but Photoshop is still there for a reason. It's a much larger learning curve, but I definitely recommend that you dive into it and try to figure out what you could do to maybe find a new creative spark.
Very cool. Well, that does it for this week of the Improved Photography Podcast. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. And please take a look at our China adventure in June 2016. All the details, everything you could want, and a video about it is at improvephotography.com/China. At least go take a look at it. And if you can make the trip, it's going to be so much fun. It's a small group of students that we're allowing to come. Four of us podcast hosts are going to be there. Nick's going to be there. I'm going to be there. Miss Sarah Kake is going to be there. And of course, Brian McGuckin as well. And we are just going to have a blast. I mean, we are going all over the Guilin area. We're shooting cormorant fishermen multiple times. We're going to try out flash. We're going to go do street photography. And this really is a workshop for everybody. There is no skill level that you have to be at. We will definitely have some people who are beginners. And I know some of the people that have signed up are much more advanced photographers as well. Because we have four instructors, we can really tailor it to wherever you are as a photographer. So don't be intimidated one tiny bit. We're going to be there to help you with everything. It's going to be just an awesome, awesome adventure. So go check it out, improvephotography.com/China. You can get your spot reserved for just a $900 down payment. I really am looking forward to this. We've worked really hard to get the cost down. International travel is always expensive, but I mean, this is the kind of thing you're going to remember your entire life. So if there's any way you can make it happen, come with me, improvephotography.com/China. Thanks, everybody, and we'll see you in another 7 days.